Good morning. We're going to call the Tax Committee to order. And today, we're going to hear the tax expenditure report from Dr. Wilson and Revenue. This is a report that's produced every 2 years. And so, Dr. Wilson, please join us. We're going to, what we're thinking about doing here is to try to hold questions till Dr. Wilson's done. You know, it seems like every year when these kind of reports come out, people get really into the questions really quickly, and then we don't get through the report. And so we're really trying to only have this be one meeting. So I think if that's okay with folks, we're going to try to hold questions until Dr. Wilson's through everything, and then members can ask about any parts of his presentation or anything else related to tax expenditures. So with that, welcome Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Paul Wilson from the Tax Research Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about the report. I'll try to go fairly quickly through these slides. If I go too quickly, you can try to slow me down, but I do want to get through them so that you can ask some questions. This is the 12th Minnesota Tax Expenditure Report. These reports were mandated by 1983 legislation authored by Representative Paul Ogren in the House and Senator Eric Petty in the Senate. The first study was completed in 1985, and we were the 10th state to adopt a tax expenditure report. These reports are due on February 1st of even-numbered years. They're now out of the budget cycle. It used to be due on the same time as the budget was. That was done to separate the timing for our convenience of incident studies versus tax expenditure budgets instead of having them both due in the same year. And it's a major project. It includes estimates for almost 300 separate items. There are 12 of our analysts involved in the work, plus a full-time intern in the summer. The leadership of this is really Carolyn Carlson in our office, and her leadership is, she's been here through all these studies for 25 years, maintaining the integrity of the study and the quality of the work. I must admit, I don't do much of anything in this report. So I want to start. The outline is, I want to start talk a little bit about why a tax expenditure report. That I know there was some discussion yesterday about that. I want to address those questions to some extent today in the beginning. I want to talk about a little bit what other states do, talk about what's in the report, and then spend a little time walking through the document, actually having you look at the document and pointing out a few things in the document itself. And then there are three issues I want to address as well. One is defining a tax expenditure. How do we choose what to include in the study? What's a tax expenditure, what isn't, basically. If you look at these things, sometimes questions come up, why isn't that in there, or why is that in there? Secondly, why don't we report total dollars of tax expenditures? Your fiscal staff have been active trying to do that, and I want to address that question, explain why we don't do that in the report. And lastly, how do tax expenditure estimates differ from revenue estimates? Sometimes when we put a revenue estimate out, people are surprised because the number doesn't match what was in the tax expenditure budget, even in the first year. And I want to explain some of those differences as well. Why a tax expenditure budget? In the preface to the report, it says the purpose is to provide information on which sound policy decisions can be made, which is pretty vague. But the purpose of this is actually, it's fairly clear that the idea is to have a review of tax provisions that are considered by, that could be defined as tax preferences. And the starting point in this analysis for those, and I'm going to come back to the opposite side in a second, but for those who really believe in tax expenditure budgeting, those who have pushed tax expenditure budgeting, start by saying, for the income tax, for example, that if the only goal were to raise revenue, it would be best to have a broad income tax base and a low rate. All else equal, there are preferences for that. It distorts less in the economy, so having a low rate and a broad base has some real advantages. However, we don't do that. Okay. If you want to encourage home ownership, then you put a mortgage interest deduction into the tax system. If you want to recognize and reward combat veterans, then you create a combat credit. If you want to help farmers pay for bovine TB testing, you have a bovine TB credit. Families pay for child care, a child care credit. If you want to help local governments, one way to do that, exempt interest on local government bonds so they can sell bonds at a lower interest rate. In these cases, there are other goals. These are other purposes of the tax structure. And the main point for those who look at tax expenditure budgets is that you could design a direct expenditure program to meet each of those goals. Okay, there are other ways to promote home ownership. One way of keeping property taxes low, The property tax refund program is one. You could design low-income, low-interest loans for first-time home buyers. There are a lot of ways. In fact, we do promote home ownership outside of the tax system. Certainly, the combat credit could have been run directly through Veterans Affairs. They know the identity of each person and could have done that directly. The child care credit, we have child care credit. We also have sodding fee child care system. They're not very well integrated. There's some question about almost conflicting goals in them. But the starting point for those who talk about tax expenditures is that these are in some sense like expenditure programs. They're trying to fulfill some goal. The difference between tax expenditures and direct expenditures, though, is number one, there's no line in the budget. You can't look at a budget document and see a line for what it costs. So if you look at all the budget documents the governor put out last year, you can't see what these items cost because they're not line items in the budget. And there's no regular review process. I mean, you could set one up, but tax expenditures, these ideas, these things do not get reviewed in a regular way. They're authorized by different committees, so the housing programs get authorized by the Housing Committee and the Mortgage Interest Deduction is in the Tax Committee, so there's some problem of coordinating any review. And there's more limited public access to program information. If the JobZ program will run as a direct expenditure program by deed, some of that information become public information. You run through the tax system, suddenly it's all private information, and as a result, it's harder to even analyze the impacts of programs because you can't get the public, and you can't get the information necessary to do those kind of analyses. But of course, there's also a political difference. The difference is that one of these approaches reduces revenue rather than, and the other one increases spending. And most measures of the size of government are based upon spending. And so it looks like tax expenditures make government smaller and direct spending makes government larger. But we know you have a balanced budget requirement. Given the need to balance the budget, let's forget tax expenditures. If you have a direct expenditure, if you were to spend money as a direct expenditure, you either have to spend less somewhere else or you have to raise taxes. Okay? A direct expenditure program has to be funded either by cutting something else or raising taxes. A tax expenditure is similar in the sense that to fund that, to do that, you have to either cut spending somewhere else or raise taxes. And so it's really an accounting identity. There is a cost here. And as a result, if you do this, if you have this provision in the tax code, and in turn, the tax expenditure argument, if you forego that revenue, you could make the revenue up for higher taxes, or you could forego the revenue and cut expenditures. But there is a cost, and the tax expenditure budget is designed to measure that cost. Tax expenditures is meant to be a non-pejorative term. Tax loophole is what you use, what you talk about when you really want to slam something. Tax expenditures, those who really designed, who really came up with the idea, really think of it as a neutral term. The idea is these are good, these are bad. There's no particular reason why the tax system isn't the best way to do some of these things. And so it's not like they're bad things, but the question is simply that they need to be evaluated. It's sort of the philosophy. Okay, is there a liberal bias in this document? Well, I just want to make a couple of points. One is that the best example of the use of the tax expenditure budget that I know of was President Reagan's use of it. President Reagan, looking at the tax expenditure budget, when he was shown the tax expenditure budget at the federal level and went through it, he realized that, and the argument was made, if you in fact broaden the tax base, the income tax base, you can lower the rates. And that's what the 1987 tax reform was all about. It was not about raising revenue because it was supposed to be revenue neutral. It was not about making the system more progressive or less progressive because it was supposed to preserve the progressivity in the tax system. It was simply about broadening the tax base and doing it in a way that brought the rates down. The rates came down a lot. So, to some extent, if you want an example of the use of it for purposes that some of the critics of tax expenditure budgets would like, I think the Reagan example may be one to follow. But there are some problems in the way the report is handles this. We talk about foregone revenue. And the only thing we report in the report is foregone revenue. You could look at this instead and say, look, the cost of a tax expenditure might be you forego the revenue, or it might be you've got to raise the tax rate. And so you could think about reporting the change in the tax rate as another alternative method of the cost. And I want to just take you ahead a couple slides. I'm going to come back, but just ahead a couple slides to something that's actually shown on page, I think it's page 99 of the report. If you can see this, fine. If you can't see this, then page 99 of the report is where you can find it. I'm sorry. That may be the wrong page. Page 59. I want to come back to this. But at the bottom of this, you see what state, what we always show in this. The state general fund, we look at the fiscal year impact. This is the foregone revenue. The home mortgage interest deduction, the cost of that, the foregone revenue, is about $400 million a year. Now, we know that for about $100 million a year, you can reduce the income tax rates by 0.1% in all three brackets. So $400 million, you could reduce the income tax brackets by 0.4% in all three brackets. That would be another way to look at the size of this tax expenditure. And we could look at this as foregone revenue and have another line below it that says the foregone reduction in income tax rates, if you wanted to use it to fund a reduction in interest rates, income tax rates, and it would be 0.4%. You could go from 5.35 at the bottom rate down to 4.95, 7.05 down to 6.65, 7.85 down to 7.45. You could do that sort of parallel reduction in rates, and you'd have enough money to do that, in fact, if you didn't have the deduction for mortgage interest. So, again, the cost of the tax expenditure can be looked at either as foregone revenue or as the need to increase tax rates within the system. And maybe a better way, we do that with the sales tax quite a bit. When we presented the sales tax, House File 2163, a couple years ago, tax broadening, we actually showed something that showed not just the amount of revenue that could be raised by including that at the current rate, but also how much you could fund a reduction in the rate if you expanded the sales tax base. It's a little hard with income tax because we've got three rates. We don't just have one rate. But you can still think about it. But the basic identity is if you, in fact, include the home mortgage interest deduction, which may be a good thing to do, but if you do, there is a cost for that, which is either foregone revenue or higher rates. There's one other criticism of the tax expenditure budget, though. I mean, you know, foregone revenue is one thing. Another criticism is we do not include behavioral changes, and I think some could say that that creates a bias because to the extent that business tax expenditures that benefit business create a stimulus to the economy, we're not showing any of those feedback effects. We don't do that on tax expenditure, tax on revenue estimates very much either, but there is a criticism there to some extent as well. So, 41 states and the District of Columbia now have tax expenditure reports. And the Center for Budget and Public Priorities, in a study last year, surveyed all the reports and is a quote that says, Oregon, Minnesota, and Connecticut published relatively comprehensive and informative reports that could serve as a model for other states. So our report is basically seen as one of the best reports in the nation by those who do those comparisons. They have a bunch of criteria, and I don't want to spend much time on this, but you know, the criteria, they want them to be published at least every 2 years. They want you to be able to find them online. Almost all states do that. They want them to cover all major taxes. Almost all states do that. If you go down a ways, if you look on the right-hand side, the number of states that do this, include a description of how each item works. Almost everyone does that. Almost everyone includes legal citations. But the other items, a lot of the other items we do are not done by most states. Less than half of the states with the sales tax include expanding sales tax base to services in the tax expenditure budget. Less than half include federal exemptions to deductions, which are sort of passive. When you conform to a federal law which has a tax expenditure in it, then that's a passive, sort of a passive adoption of a tax expenditure. Only half about have forward-looking estimates. The others just look at some historic time or 1 year in the past. And basically, less than half include each year's enactment. The things we don't do are listed at the bottom. We don't divide these things into program categories like housing, defense, whatever. We don't list a rationale for each expenditure. We don't include evaluation of each expenditure. And we don't show distribution of benefit by income level in the tax incidence study. So those are things we don't do. If you look at the authorization language, which is the last page of the report, you'll see that those are allowed. The report may include those. We have not done that in this report. We have not done that, except with two exceptions. We've not done the distributional work in past reports either. However, I put an asterisk by that in the table because last year, those of you on this committee last year know that there were some distributional information provided last year to this committee on the distribution of tax expenditures. This is, and, sorry. Never mind. I do want to talk about the home mortgage. This is just an illustration of one page in the report, or one item in the report. This is what I talked about, but because there's a lot of information in here, and sometimes people don't look at it. They just look at the numbers in the first table, the summary table, and they don't look back in here to get more information. There's a lot in here. It starts by having the citation. So if you want to know where something is in the code, it's a nice place to look to find where that is in the code. The first two paragraphs give you a good description of this mortgage, home mortgage interest deduction, including the caps that were put on, $1 million of debt, et cetera. The third paragraph gives you some history about when things were changed. The fourth line there tells you, the fourth paragraph tells you the number of people who are affected by it. Each of these things we try to include on each of the tax expenditures to the extent we can. And then, of course, the fiscal impact at the bottom. So there really is some good information, some descriptive information on each of the items. This is the distribution. I'm not going to talk about this, but you had this report last year. You know that we did do some distributional information on tax expenditures last year. At the bottom of the page, just some similar information was provided for 16 income tax and 14 sales tax items last year to this committee and included in a document authored by House Research. That document is available in the Legislative Research Library. It's not online as far as I can tell, but certainly the committee would have access to that document. We did it for our income tax items. We did it also for sales tax items. And you, those of you who are here recall that, and if you don't recall that, you should get a copy of the whole publication rather than my trying to talk about it here. At this point, what I'd like to do is to have you actually take out your tax expenditure budget. I want you to take a look at a couple of things in the document itself. Can I do this? That's the question. Okay, I'll do it without anything on the screen. If you go online for this document and look at this document, the online version has some boxes on the first page. And on the online version, we've tried to make links so you can get around easier. But if you get your document out, the very first page, you don't have this on your document because yours was printed from something that was designed for a printed copy. But online, there's some boxes, and I want to point out why we put that on there. The box says, gives you a link to the introduction, and it says, those who use this report should read the introduction, which addresses the following question. What is a tax expenditure and what is not? How are tax expenditures estimated? Why could it be misleading to add tax expenditures together? And how do tax expenditures differ from revenue estimates? It's four pages. Now, it's a dense four pages, but it's only four pages. If you want to use a tax expenditure budget, I really do encourage people to read the introduction. We also have links on there to the table of contents. And table of contents, of course, is toward the front of the book. It doesn't have a page number on it. But if you look at the table of contents, let me just point out something in the table of contents as well. There's a different chapter for each tax. Each chapter has an introduction, and those introductions have a lot of information in them. They will tell you what the tax collected. They will give you some history of the tax. They will talk about what the tax base is that's assumed for tax expenditure purposes that I'll talk about in a bit. They give you the way the tax is calculated. They tell. They also will give you some information about just the history of changes, I guess, in particular. So, again, each chapter has an introduction. Some of that information is in the tax handbook as well. It's sort of, some of it's repetitive to the tax handbook, but it has information in it that's very important to understand the tax expenditures. And the tax expenditures are organized in a particular order. For income tax, we start with the federal, the so-called passive tax expenditures, the ones that are where we conform to something the federal government does, like the mortgage interest deduction, okay? Those are dealt with first, and then the things that are specifically Minnesota-based rather than piggybacking on the feds are done in later sections for the individual income and corporate tax. The general sales tax, the organization is divided up into things which are just exemptions for goods or services for particular items first, and then exemptions that depend upon the identity of the purchaser, whether it's schools who get an exemption or whether it's a nonprofit organization that can buy things tax exempt. And finally, exemptions that are based on the identity of the seller. So there is some rhyme or reason here to the order of these. They're not, on the other hand, this is a big document and it's hard to get through it. If you turn over a couple pages to, and I'm sorry I can't do this, look at page 5, you see the beginning of the list. And again, online, you can go directly to this from the cover. You can go to the summary list of tax expenditures. And then if you can find something on that list, you can click on it, and it'll take you directly to the item. And if you click back on that, again, it'll take you back to where you were. So it's fairly easy to go through to find things in here. You can also do searches on the document. If, for example, you wanted to find the mortgage interest deduction, one way is just to type in search mortgage interest, and it'll go to, actually go to the summary page first, but then you can click on that and you'll go to the other page. But so it's a searchable document. So it's a very large document. It's a little hard to handle online, but it has that information in it. If you look at the list of taxes, you'll notice that it does include, we do include property taxes, local property taxes on the list. We don't include the state property tax. You also won't find the Minnesota. Also, don't find the Minnesota hair taxes on there. We've never included that tax. There's no particular reason not to. State property tax is just that the base is so odd we can't figure out what the norm is to judge it against, so it creates some problems. I'm looking at slide 12. Okay, slide 12, it's a tax expenditure only if. Okay, first of all, it's a tax expenditure only if the tax applies statewide. So we don't have many local taxes, except for the local property tax. Local taxes are not included in the report. If they're done by special law, basically, is the argument there. Secondly, we have to provide preferential treatment. And again, that's a judgment call to some extent. We follow, for income tax, we follow the Joint Committee on Taxation and how they handle these things. But for example, the standard deduction and the dependent exemption are not considered tax expenditures. They're considered not to be preferences because everybody gets the same thing. Although it does depend upon filing status. But they have to be preferential items, in other words, and we do rule out a few items because of that. It must have a revenue impact. This means that the sales tax exemption for the St. Charles food processing plant is not in the report this year. It doesn't look at this point like that is going to get rebuilt. And so items like that, the international development, international zone, some of the biozones, things that are in, they're in statute, but there's no cost because they effectively, they only cost, we don't put them in as a zero, we just don't put them in the report at all. It's not it's a tax expenditure only if it's not subject to an alternative tax. We know that the motor vehicles are exempt from the general sales tax, but they have their own sales tax. Cigarettes are exempt from the general sales tax, but there's an in-lieu tax. Solid waste taxes are in lieu of the sales tax, as are lottery tickets. So if there is an alternative tax out for the taxes, then we don't sort of assume they're exempt from something if they're paying it in some other way. Fifth, it's a tax expenditure rather only if it's not counted as a direct expenditure. If you already can see the cost of this in a line in the budget, there's no real reason to put it in this report. So the property tax refund is an expenditure program. Even though it's tax related, if it were on the income tax return, it'd probably be in here, but it's a budget item, as is the political contribution credit. Sixth, it's only a tax expenditure the legislature has authority to impose tax, so something like the exemption for federal bond interest, we're not allowed to tax that as a state, so there's no reason, again, to put those numbers in there. And lastly, it's a tax expenditure only if it's included in the definition of the tax base. And this is a little bit, again, a judgment call. What if you consider tax expenditures to be exceptions to something, what are the exceptions to? It's an exception to some kind of a norm. You have to have a norm against which to measure tax expenditures, and by defining the tax base that you're going to start with is sort of, we don't like to use the term pure tax, but it's sort of like, what are we measuring the exceptions against? For income taxes, the definition of the base is income from all sources less expenses that are reasonable and necessary to generate that income. So basically all income is included. If it's income, it's in the base. So whether it's public assistance income, that's still included in the tax base, and you'll see that item in the tax expenditure report. This means that there's a deduction when it says only expenses that are reasonable and necessary. A couple things to point out: deduction is only allowed in this pure base for true depreciation. True depreciation, first we have to define what that means, and again we do follow JCT on that. But accelerated depreciation is considered to be a tax expenditure. And the tax expenditure is the difference between the accelerated, what you, when you pay, the tax you pay under accelerated and the tax you pay under true economic depreciation. That's a timing issue only, but because the tax gets paid, you report the income eventually. It's only a timing issue, but it does in fact show up in the tax expenditure budget because if you look at it sort of through time, it's always going to have a cost to the state. Personal dependent exemptions are not in the tax, are not considered in the base, so they're not considered to be tax expenditures. The graduated rates are assumed to be part of it. In other words, we assume this is a progressive income tax. And so the rate structure is not considered to be part of the analysis. And for corporate tax, the study assumes equal weight apportionment, equal weights to property to property sales and payroll. And so our higher weight on sales is considered the tax expenditure. And it also includes a throwback rule in the norm. So you'll see a throwback rule also in the report. The sales tax is actually, I would say the income tax is not defined. The income is not defined like a public finance economist would define it. Public finance economists would define income much more broadly than this and include things like the imputed value of home ownership and things that, and capital gains income as it accrues rather than when they're realized. Those are not in here. In other words, this is not meant to be an academic document. This is meant to be something that's useful for legislators. So the more esoteric definition issues of income are not included in the base. The sales tax, we define the base in our studies and have from the beginning as to include all final purchases of tangible goods or services.
Good point.
Final purchases. Well, that includes some business purchases. So this is not a definition of sales tax that says the sales tax is a consumption tax. If it were a consumption tax, then purchases that are not done as part of consumption would not, in fact, be tax expenditures. So realize, the capital equipment exemption is considered to be a tax expenditure in this report simply because it is a final sale of a product that's not resold again. Purchases, items that are bought for resale or resources that are purchased and used in the manufacturing process, those are not considered to be tax expenditures. They're not considered to be in the base. This is a judgment call. Most public finance economists would say sales tax should be a consumption tax, and so this doesn't match the normal definition. I know in some cases people have tried to only look at tax expenditures that are consumption tax expenditures purchased by consumers, and in that case you're not going to look at all of them. So just be aware, this is a definition. Other states are different. There's no federal rule to look at. We don't have any model. Other states have been much more broad in this or much narrower. Some states do not include services in their definition of the norm at all. And some states include even items, the exemption for items that are used in production, they include that as a tax expenditure. So states are all over the place in how they define these items. Why don't we report a tax expenditure total for all items combined? There are a couple of reasons for this, and I'll talk in the next couple of slides on these. One is you can't just simply add them up. Okay? You can't simply sum the tax expenditures because when you do more than one of them at a time, there are interactions between them. And those interactions can be positive, which means if you do two things together, the total cost of doing both is actually more than the sum of the two. Or they can be negative, where if you do things together, it actually would have less foregone revenue than if you added up the two separately. And I'll talk a little bit more about those interactions. In addition to the sales tax, the list is really incomplete. There are a lot of things that are left out in the sales tax area that I'll mention. So a total wouldn't really be a total. And I think that's the main reason in the sales tax area why we have difficulty. This is an example of why tax expenditures are not additive. On the left-hand side is simply the sum of all the tax expenditures for itemized deductions that are included in the study. Home mortgage interest, $418 million. This is fiscal year 11. Charitable contributions, $202. Real estate taxes, $184. Other medical expenses, $64. And a little more for the others. You add them up, you get $880 million. So you'd say, oh, well, the sum for itemized deductions is $880 million. Well, that's not true, because if you itemize deductions, once you get down to the standard deduction, you can't drop any further. Okay, once you become a non-itemizer, you can't get hurt by losing these things after that. And the impact of that is that if you actually did them all together and we had one tax expenditure for all itemized deductions together, it would be $637 million. The cost of doing it all together is 27.5% less, 27.5% less, $243 million or less or something like that. It's a pretty big difference. So adding together really can be misleading, and we don't encourage addition. Okay. We also find positive interactions. This one is the additional standard deduction for the elderly and blind. If you do that first, the tax expenditure budget says $15.5 million. But what if you, in fact, got rid of all the itemized deductions and had already done that, and then you put this on top? Well, remember, when you have itemized deductions, a lot of the elderly are itemizers. So they don't benefit from the standard deduction for the additional standard deduction because they're not taking the standard deduction. They're taking the itemized deduction. If you get rid of the itemized deduction, suddenly every elderly person, all the seniors are going to benefit from this. Many more people will benefit, and the cost goes up by 87%. So again, you got it. These have interactions. It's really dangerous to add them together. On the income tax, most of the other interactions are positive. We have a progressive income tax. You start adding items on, you're going to start moving people into higher tax brackets. So you tend to have a positive interaction primarily. Except for itemized deductions, most of them are positive interactions. And they can be big. But federal tax expenditures are estimated to be about 16.5%. They'd be much lower than that here. But still, you might have to add 4 or 5% on to the numbers in the report due to these interactions if you're trying to get a total. Sales tax also has interactions. They're probably smaller, but sometimes if we do the tax benefit tax for capital equipment, we assume the Job Z exemption is there. We do Job Z, we assume capital equipment exemption is there. Neither one includes the revenue loss from taxing capital equipment in job zones. So if you did both things, you'd actually pick up some revenue that's in neither of the tax expenditures separately. The omission of sales tax items, on page 108 of the report, and I encourage you, if you can, just to turn to this real quickly because there is a change here in how we've done things. We have, this is the biggest tax expenditure, I think, in the entire report. It's $2.5 billion. But, of course, we could have written separate ones for all of these selected services. The selected services item, on page 108, you can see we have broken these into individual pieces, but we've also separated the business part from the consumption part. And again, I think that was really at the request of people on the tax committees. But one thing to notice is this is selected services. This doesn't include all consumer services or all business services. This is selected. Selected services, it doesn't include medical services, it doesn't include housing services, it doesn't include educational services, or a bunch of other things that are not included in here either. So if you added all these up, you actually are missing some tax expenditures because the total ought to include all of them, not just the ones that we've selected to put in here. So you have a little problem adding up those as well. Just continue. If we try to add them up, thank you. If we try to add them up, you could take the simple sum, and I know Cynthia, I know that these have been added up. Some of you have seen these numbers. What's the total? You can add them up. Add all the numbers. You get $4.898 billion for individual income tax, some of expenditures. If we took the negative interaction for itemized deductions out, and we add the positive interaction we saw for the standard deduction for elderly, but there are a lot of other positive interactions, too. What do we get? Well, we get something like 4.669 plus an unknown number for interactions, which may be $150, $200 million. Okay? Those interactions are probably going to be positive, the other ones. And so you'd add a bit to that if you tried to get a complete number for income tax. For general sales tax, you can add them up. The positive interactions probably are not nearly as important on sales tax as they are in income tax, but the omissions are large. And so you might add a billion or two to that if you actually included some of the other ones that are not included in the report. So to look at this and try to come up with totals, it seems like you've got a lot of question marks added. We do not report totals. We think that the interactions and other things are in some of the problems of things that are left out make that problematic at best. Finally, one last thing, and then I just got a couple. The last four are real quick. Unlike revenue estimates, tax expenditure estimates differ from revenue estimates in a number of ways. First of all, tax expenditures by definition ignore interactions among the provisions. Whereas if you get a tax revenue estimate, you're going to find out, as some of you have found out, that you're going to get interaction effects where you sort of look at the two, and then you get this interaction, which may, in fact, make it cost more or less, depending on which direction you're going. Secondly, tax expenditures ignore any impact on other taxes. If you were to do something with the motor vehicle registration tax, it would change the motor vehicle registration tax. You're going to change itemized deductions on the income tax, which will have an interaction effect on the income tax. We would show that on revenue estimate. We don't show that on tax expenditures. And there are other ones like the PTR for property taxes and things where you get these interactions and they're not considered here. For revenue estimates, effective dates matter. you know, most of you know, if you put something in the sales tax and you start July 1st, you only get 11 months of collections. But also, if you phase something in over time, you're not going to match the tax expenditure numbers at all. And anything that deals with deferral of taxes, you're going to get very different numbers on a revenue estimate than you see in the tax expenditure budget. Tax expenditures do not take issues of collectability into account. Sales tax nexus is not really, we do that on revenue estimate, but on tax expenditures, at least they're not addressed very carefully. So we really don't wrestle with those issues as much as we would in a revenue estimate either. So the exception for magazine subscriptions it doesn't really adjust downwards for the fact that we don't have nexus to tax those. People owe a use tax on it, or maybe not, because of de minimis. So anyway, we don't deal with some of those issues. We also don't take collectability into account for some of the federal items that we couldn't do by ourselves. There are a lot of those federal exemptions and deductions which do not occur. They don't show up on a line on the tax return. We would have an awful time trying to find the data. We probably cannot, in fact, conform unless the feds did as well. So some of these things that are even listed may not be possible administratively to tax that item, because we just couldn't get the information to do audits. And finally, although some criticize us for not doing enough of this on revenue estimates, on the tax expenditures, there's no attempt to adjust for behavioral changes at all. The last four slides are almost more for fun than for anything else, but these show the counts through time since 1985. If you look at the totals, though, you find it's pretty hard to interpret these. You know, one tax expenditure is $2.5 billion, another one is less than $50,000. You're adding them up as if they count the same. The trends are sort of strange. You know, it looks like they've gone up through time, but the high point occurred in 2002. If you compare 2000, at the bottom of the slide, it says the total that were present in 2010 but not in 2000 is 43, and yet the net number has only gone up by 4. So obviously, there are a lot of these that are coming in and going out through time. There's more movement among tax expenditures than you might think by just looking at this kind of a table. Difficulty interpreting counts. For income tax, you can see the effects of the 1987 tax reform, though, very clearly here. The 1987 study was before tax reform. The 1989 study was after tax reform. There was a significant simplification of the tax structure. I have the 1987 tax reform here, tax form here. It's one page. It is 17 lines, maybe 19, depending on how you count. One side of the page, if you want to look at tax complexity, compare that form with today's tax form, and you can sort of see what the effects of various tax expenditures do to complexity. And I list the ones that are new to this study there as well since the last study. The count for sales tax, it's an upward climb fairly steadily, but again, you've got some going in and some coming out. And the new ones are listed at the bottom. For corporate tax, you've got to be particularly careful about counts. It looks like something really happened between 2000 and 2002. Man, we must have simplified the system a lot, and we did. But it's really the effect of nine corporate tax expenditures for insurance companies that all went away when insurance companies were just exempted from the tax. So now there's only one. So we went from nine little ones to one big one that's bigger than the nine small ones. And yet, it looks like we've made progress about tax expenditures. So, again, the caution is just counting tax expenditures probably doesn't do much good, but they're nice graphs to look at. So. Again, we hope the study can be useful. I think it does get quite a bit of use. Again, I do realize that there's a lot of information in here. I just encourage you to use the report fully rather than just looking at the summary list. If you want to know how we treat what we assume true depreciation is, look under accelerated depreciation, the explanation, and it will in fact tell you what we assume for true depreciation. Those complexities are in there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. So we're going to go to questions and discussion. I do have a question for you, Dr. Wilson, but first I do want to highlight that you tried to, in the beginning and the end, sort of point out the behavioral change thing, and I think it's important for members who are really interested in understanding that to sit down with Dr. Wilson or others who can assist. Folks confuse revenue estimates and tax expenditures, and we do bills on revenue estimates, not on tax expenditures, and of course the tax expenditures don't show those behavioral changes, but the interactions are really important, and I know when I've tried to do bills on eliminating or repealing tax expenditures, there's huge amounts of interactions in the hundreds of millions of dollars as people try to go through these, and so if members are interested in doing these bills, the key is to get your bill in early. When I tried to do the full kind of restructure and relook and sort of do means testing on a progressive basis, I was sending things to Dr. Wilson in November before session, because the interactions are really complicated and they take a lot of time for people to really try to give their best analysis for who it impacts. So I think members who are interested in this really need to understand that it's not a simple thing, and they need to get working early to try to get their bills. You can't just throw one in and then expect it to be back in a week and have all these interactions going on. But I did want to ask you, you talked in your slide, I think number six maybe, when you were talking about President Reagan in the beginning, when President Reagan really started using tax, looking at tax expenditures and really moved the country to begin to analyze them and get rid of a lot of them and recognize that they either cost less services for taxpayers in getting something else in the federal budget or higher rates embedded because of these choices. Do you know if the Reagan administration was looking at all in progressivity and trying to judge, you know, who are the beneficiaries of these expenditures as deciles of income, or was it sort of a political calculation, like we can stop having people deduct their credit card interest? Or, I mean, do you have any sense, because I certainly wasn't tracking this in 1987, but when, you know, politically, how did, you know, such a conservative president be able to achieve just probably the most noteworthy success in the United States history in this area? Was it a political sort of attack on all this stuff, or just, hey, we don't have the money?
Madam Chair, for those of you like me who remember that history, those the older people here. What the president really did was, the president said he wanted the Department of Treasury to do a study, come up with a proposal, and release it after the election. So to some extent, the impetus came from from the Treasury Department, that came up with Tax Reform Proposal 1, basically, in 1984-85. But I think it was clear that the goal all along was, that the thing that made this work was that it was to be revenue neutral, but it was also to not make the system either much less or much more progressive. It was really to maintain the progressivity. And if you think about what that tax did, it actually did drop the top tax rate all the way down to 25%. Right? The very top was only paying 25%. Interesting enough, in the middle there was a higher rate, so it was sort of an interesting. But the margin, the average rate, never got above 25%. But remember what it did. He taxed capital gains were taxed in full.
Yeah.
Accelerated depreciation went away. A bunch of tax items that were used basically as tax shelters disappeared. There were some things that way. In order to protect the lower end, the working family credit was expanded quite a bit. And the reason it was expanded the way it was we were basically, you know, I was working at that time, but we were actually told, you got to get that effective tax rates, what doesn't rise at the bottom end, and the only way to do that very effectively was to increase the working family credit. I mean, the goal was very clearly not to distort, because it wouldn't go otherwise, was not to try to change either the progressivity or the total tax revenue, but rather try to simplify, lower rates, broaden the base, simplify. But you had those constraints, so you couldn't do some things. And, of course, he also just ruled some things out completely from the beginning, like home mortgage interest, which was ruled out from the beginning. So. And he did tighten up. I mean, you got a cap on only $1 million of debt, et cetera, but it was basically ruled out from the beginning.
So, and then just as a follow-up, because I'm trying to kind of big picture it and sit before we just jump into the detail with questions from members. So if more simplification with the homework assignment of has to be revenue neutral and we want to retain progressivity was the goal that was probably fairly well achieved. When the governor's 21st century task force on taxes, or I can't remember the commission that Chair Bekich headed up for the governor, released its study, I guess that was last year, was it 2 years ago, I can't recall. Is it fair to say they sort of did the same thing? They wanted a revenue-neutral product. They maybe weren't going for simplification, but they did repeal all kinds of tax expenditures, you know, in the sales tax area. They broadened the base and brought a whole bunch of people online who were going to start paying taxes with a lower rate, and then they paid for, what they bought with that then is all the business tax cuts. Was it sort of a similar exercise using, they stayed in the sales tax arena, and I think they had a cigarette tax too, but the same kind of thing that, geez, there's a lot of revenue over here. If you would not have expenditures riddled throughout the sales tax and you turned them off, you could raise a lot of revenue and either return it in tax cuts or do it on, you know, business incentive programs or whatever. Is that kind of a similar philosophy for the 21st Century Tax Reform Commission?
Madam Chair, I think the instructions for that commission were to be revenue neutral.
Mm-hmm.
They, of course, did not really talk about what they were going to do in sales tax base expansion. They just sort of said they're going to do something. So it isn't quite clear what that would have ended up being.
Okay.
I don't think the progressivity issue ever really was addressed in terms of the overall system remaining the same progressivity. It was more a case of moving toward consumption taxes and reducing taxes on business or business income. So we never did an analysis of sort of the overall impact because there never was a proposal on the sales tax side that really could be looked at. But clearly some of those proposals would have had would have changed the distribution of the burden quite a bit. If you expand the sales tax, you tend to make the system more regressive if you don't lower the rate. And again, the proposal just wasn't complete enough, the final proposal, to really respond very well to the question, I think.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Wilson, your comments about the 1987 changes made me recall something that may or may not be correct. There was the study that came out in June of 08 from OMB or CBO or someone saying that corporations essentially weren't paying taxes and modifications might be appropriate in light of that. In 1987, which I don't know because I was in junior high, I recall something about it being said that the top tier income tax rate was just not paid at all during that time because of the wide availability of tax shelters. Is that true? And if not, how much revenue was derived from the top rate, if you know?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I really don't know the answer to that question. I mean, certainly some people were paying the top rate, but I can't answer it. I would say that one of the effects of the reform was to actually increase corporate income taxes. In some sense, it was revenue neutral, but it tended to reduce individual and raise corporate, I think, the overall effect. I wouldn't say that was necessarily intended, but when it was actually put into effect, that seemed to be the result. But I really don't have a good answer, except the tax shelters were very important and did sort of erode the effect of the top tax rate. That's certainly clear.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Oh, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and a great read if you want to go back and look at the Reagan reform in 1986 was the book called The Showdown at Gucci Gulch.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it this summer, and it wouldn't have made any sense to me even 2 years ago, but after the work that we did last year on the expenditures, it made a lot of sense, just the politics. It's a great read, but President Reagan was driven by lowering the tax rate. That was above everything else. And in fact, the final report didn't go the final law changes did not go as far as President Reagan wanted, but with politics, he wasn't able to do as much. So he actually wanted to go further. And Gucci Gulch got the term where Robert Dole one time, in looking out at all the lobbyists who were out in this hallway, called it, look at them out in Gucci Gulch, referring to their fancy suits and so forth like that. That came from Senator Dole. But just like I said, it's just great politics and goes behind the scenes and all the give and take of all that happened there. But one thing that I find interesting is the fact that depending on what numbers we use, we're probably talking about a $10 to $11 billion item on these tax expenditures a year, which is about 40% of our budget. You know, about 40%. And there's no line in the budget, no regular review process. You know, when we talk around here about transparency, that is a huge, huge problem. We've got 40% of the budget that does not get a review and basically is hidden from the public. And I would suggest you know, especially in times of tight economic and budgetary times, that this tax committee or some group take a good hard look. And you can start out with a revenue neutral approach, but you know, you go through there, many of these tax expenditures, you have the date 1933 by them, the year the income tax started in Minnesota, 70-some years ago. And we need to look, when we have limited dollars, to, you know, are they doing what they are supposed to do? And I thought that report last year was a great report, and I know House staff and Dr. Wilson and others worked on that, where you looked at if, in fact, some of these are actually incentivizing what it's supposed to be doing. And I think a lot of them, there's some huge question marks. And so should we just be, you know, throwing dollars out there and having them land wherever they are in times of tight budgets where we need to cut? I think it's very incumbent upon us as a body, as a tax committee, to take a look to see if, in fact, because I think if we were to look at this in just in a vacuum, in keeping the same amount of money, we would probably have a whole new structure of where we would put those dollars based on today's priorities rather than 1933. And the other, I guess the other point I'd like to make is, you know, I think stakeholders, you know, for example, let's look at that mortgage interest deduction. I'm wondering if even the Realtors Association, if they could have the same amount of money that is spent on the property tax deduction, mortgage interest, and everything, if even they would come up with a different system and put money in different spots. And I just think that would be a great exercise, because I don't think these tax expenditures are meeting the priorities that we have today. And I don't think that's Democrat or Republican. I just think we need to really take a look at that. I don't know if Dr. Wilson, if you have any suggestions on it. Have there ever been any real efforts for the legislature to get together on some sort of a budget group and really look at these and say, what are our goals and what type of a system would we design in 2010?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mark Hart. I know that the history of the Minnesota Tax Expenditure Report is interesting, because before 1983, in 1981, there were some attempts to pass a much more a much more challenging or a much more expansive report, which would have required, would have put sunset dates, would have made all tax expenditures sunset, would have required certain review once in a while, et cetera. I mean, it would set up this big process to require the review to occur.
Okay.
But I don't know of states that have done that in the past. There have been a few states that have, states take different approaches. There are some states that have just sunset. I think there's one state that sunset all their tax expenditures over the next 3 or 4 years, maybe 5 years, and they do them in stages, you know, income tax first, but to try to require a review, at least you had to renew them, and that sort of is done. It's very hard to analyze. I mean, coming up with the numbers for these is hard enough. To actually do an analysis, I think the House research staff, I mean, we did not do that work, but the House research staff, when they did the evaluation of these, tried to give some comments on how, whether they worked or not, or what was known about them. That's a real challenge. It's not clear who is best equipped to do that, except that it's probably not my office. I'm not sure that the skill set is there, but that kind of analysis. Now, Iowa has taken a very different approach. Iowa has actually gone out and said every year there are going to be two or three of them we're going to review, and we're going to do a good job on those two or three. And they start out with historic rehabilitation credit and a few others. They've done a few in-depth studies of individual items. Trying to do them all at once or all on a continuing basis is really tough. You're not going to end up doing quite the same kind of a job. So it would be a big task to do it. But again, the legislature could set up things that would, laws could be done to do that, and that was what was attempted in 1981. And then it really pulled back and made it much more of this is just information. So this report is much more informational. And there was no attempt to try to force review by some kind of a legislative process.
Thank you. Representative Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Wilson, for, as usual, your excellent overview and presentation. I think it's appropriate and important for the Tax Committee to have this discussion and look at the policy that's behind each one of these. If you want to call it an expenditure, call it an expenditure. If you want to call it a revenue raiser, call it a revenue raiser. I'm not going to get too hung up on that. but we need to do that. And Dr. Wilson, I'm wondering if you would have some information that would help us identify which of these items, maybe Minnesota stands alone or with only a few states that have such an approach or a policy, as one possible filter here, and another volatility. The worst thing we can do is to make a change and adopt something that's very volatile, that one year it's way up, the next year it's all the way down. Those are a couple of filters that I think we would need to have these items go through in order to focus our attention. We can't take this whole list and do it all at once. We have to have a more selective approach. Is that kind of information available?
Dr. Wilson.
I'm sure Representative Lanning, for sales taxes, I know there's some listings of what is taxed in different states. Particularly in the services area, there's been a recent survey, and it's not too hard to find out what states do in the sales tax area. And there's something similar, I guess, in the income tax area. For the big items, it's not too hard to just get comparisons among the states. For smaller items, it's much tougher, obviously. I think you are right. I think you do need some kind of filters. One filter that the Department of Revenue would suggest would be just simply that it doesn't make much sense to spend a lot of time looking at something that would be administratively very difficult to do. So if you want to tax something and we can't get the information because it's really a federal tax expenditure and the information doesn't show up on a W-2, doesn't show up anywhere, I mean, for us to tax employer-provided health insurance, for example, would be very difficult. Again, we could require in-state employers maybe to report that, but what would you do with non-residents? What do you do with people who are out of state? It's just not quite clear how you could actually do that administratively. So one filter is just simply some of these things may just not, they may in fact be possible if the federal government does them at the same time, but they're not really possible going it alone. Be one filter, and I think taking a tax at a time may also make some sense, that it's easier to think about the sales tax items together than to try to combine sales tax items. I noticed that some of the bills introduced on some of this the past years, they've been either sort of income and corp or they've been sales tax. I think there's some sense in sort of thinking of these as individual tax items rather than trying to sort of go through the whole thing and all that. I mean, notice how many taxes are in here. A lot of other taxes in here, too, that have some tax expenditure items.
Dr. Wilson, as a follow-up to Representative Lanning's question, just thinking about this as one who's kind of tried to do some of this stuff here and understand that there are a lot of them that have become political nightmares because they're viewed as entitlements by the public. They feel that they have a right to them. They sort of reject outright the truth around these issues that a whole bunch of states don't have these. For example, the home mortgage deduction, you know, all kinds of states don't have that. And our next door neighbor, Wisconsin, doesn't, and they have higher home ownership rates than we do. So that kind of information gets kind of compelling to me when you're putting oodles of money into something that less than a third of Minnesotans benefit from, and you have lower home ownership when the goal is, you know, supposedly we need to have this for home ownership. You know, one filter, maybe if I took another crack at it, would be, is there a way to easily look at just the ones that, you know, less than a third or less than half of Minnesotans get? I think, you know, on the mortgage deduction one, for example, people sort of felt that's everybody's and everyone gets that. And as you look through it, absolutely not true. If you don't itemize, you don't get it. So you lose half of Minnesotans right there. And you start clocking through, is there a way to discern from the data of all these piles in here, you know, let's just take a look at the ones that a small subset of Minnesotans get. And that may be the wrong filter, but could you get that if you wanted to? Could you actually start pulling up expenditures that are received by very small amounts of filers?
Madam Chair, we do have counts on quite a few of the income tax items. it's harder to, we don't have counts on the sales tax items nearly as much. I mean, it's harder to get counts. So you won't see many counts in the sales tax items. On the other hand, it cuts two ways. If almost nobody gets it, it generally doesn't cost that much, and you don't get that much of if you're trying to reduce rates or something, you don't get much out of it. So, so in some ways, the larger ones may have. I mean, it's hard to know whether looking at the ones only a few get is going to really identify the ones that make that much makes much difference. And I would say for the income tax, there is a good study of all states that's put out by the Wisconsin legislative it's one of the, some legislative research group of some sort that puts out that does compare all 50 states, well, the 42 states with income taxes. And you can, that study does provide you with sort of what they do with itemized deductions. You can obviously go and look at forms too, but that's a fairly good summary of how states differ in how they design their income tax.
Thank you. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as I said, I think this is analysis that we ought to do, but how we approach this I think is really important. If we approach it as a revenue neutral approach, we're going to have a much better discussion, because that's going to force us then to maybe look at where the rates are too high and where we need some reduction. If we only look at it as a way of raising revenue, we're not going to get very far. But if we look at this and do this analysis, as was done in the mid-80s federally, to look at what's revenue neutral, where can we get rid of some things that no longer make any sense, and at the same time be able to provide some tax relief that is crying for action. And I think that's the best approach and where we're most likely to have success.
And I just want to say, Representative Lanning, I couldn't agree more with you. You know, I think we have our partisan differences in this room, and so we know, you know, one side doesn't want to do revenue and one side does. But I think, you know, the charge I had when I was raising $1.5 billion was to try to do it as progressively as possible. So I did take a look at this, and it became a non-starter for a lot of people, and I accept that, and I know why. So I agree with you. I will recall for the committee, though, the year before I did exactly that. I repealed all kinds of tax expenditures and cut the corporate tax rate and brought it in revenue neutral to try to demonstrate to committee members, in line with sort of the governor's philosophy before he was proposing cutting corporate taxes, I did, and I paid for it. And I repealed all kinds of tax expenditures to do it and cut the corporate tax rate. And we had that hearing, and that was sort of, you know, an attempt to sort of hold out that olive branch and say, we could get to your agenda if folks could be willing to cut some of this stuff. And I think it's going to take legislators of goodwill on both sides of the aisle for years to come to be willing to sort of put down the swords on the revenue question and have the debate on expenditures in a revenue neutral way. I agree with you. And I think, unfortunately, we've got too many people dug in both parties here who are not willing to hear that. And I don't think it's going to serve any of us well, no matter who's in the majority or who the next governor is or anything else. So I really appreciate you saying that, because it takes political insight to understand there's a whole bunch of money sitting over here, but revenue raisers are offensive to some for a myriad of reasons. So what's a common ground? And you've hit on it. And I hope more people can really hear what you just said in both parties, because that is, it is, if we look at the demographics from Dr. Stinson and Dr. Gillespie, the revenue is not going to be there, you know, for the next 10 to 20 years. We're heading in the other direction, and people are just going to have to get a lot more creative. And this nonpartisan report could really assist us if people want to try. And I think you've hit on the trick, you know, is in the end, is raising revenue or not. But to start the discussion, every member of this committee can bring in a bill revenue neutral and can try to cut some stuff and buy tax cuts if that's what they want to buy with it. And so I really appreciate you bringing that up, because that's a tough one for everybody here. We have Garofalo, then Downey, Liebling, Gardner. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a commentary, I think overall we're going to be seeing a trend nationwide about reducing taxes on savings and investment and having that burden shifted to consumption taxes. And I think we're going to see that conversation play out both nationally and on a state basis outside of the expenditure discussion. Dr. Wilson, just two quick questions. During the Carter years before President Reagan was elected, I believe the top federal tax rate was 70%. Is that correct?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, I know it had been that high at one point. I don't know what the top rate was right before the red band.
Mr.
Michael knows.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, there are really two federal top tax rates in the 1970s and early 80s before the first Reagan tax cut, what we call IRTA. There was a 70% rate that applied to non-earned income like wages and salary and self-employed income, and then there was a provision that effectively said that if you have just wait on your wage income and your self-employment income, you could not pay more than 50%. And those rates got, you know, they got cut in the in stages, both as part of the in part of IRTA, and then of course in the 1986 tax reform that reduced it down. So investment income had that higher 70% rate than wage income did.
And,
and Madam Chair, and then Dr. Wilson or Mr. Michael, just what, in, at the time, what was the top rate in Minnesota?
Mr. Michael.
Either one.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, it's a little bit confusing because, well, first of all, there's a period of time involved, and secondly, we had we allowed federal deductibility. But in Minnesota, when I started working here, for example, we had a top rate of that was in effect. There was on the statutes, there was an 18% rate that was supposed to go into effect, but it was repealed before it ever went into effect. But the top rate when I started was basically 16%. But there was federal deductibility. So understand that if you are a top earner and you were paying the 70% top rate on investment income, you earn a dollar and you pay 70 cents in federal tax, and you could deduct that 70 cents, thinking on the margin again. So the residual is 30%. If you multiply 30% times 16%, that would give you your effective Minnesota top tax rate. In 1985, we switched and we gave people the choice of taking a federal tax deduction or not taking a federal tax deduction, and then we had two different rate schedules to make things really nice and simple. and both of them were lowered. And in 87, when we had our big tax reform, we went down to the 8.5% top rate.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's interesting. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of comments. I share Representative Lanning's and your statements that if we could try and attack some of this in a relatively bipartisan way, we could make some good headway, especially if we had it revenue neutral. But just an observation on that, I mean, there's no way we can do anything in this legislature here in St. Paul revenue neutral unless we get at the spending side of the equation. I mean, none of this works. I mean, this discussion is all just, you know, kind of beer talk if we're not willing to attack the spending side of the equation. So somehow we've got to find the will in the legislature as well to deal with the spending side of it. But to advance where we're going, I wonder if maybe some hearings would make sense. And I know I signed on to Representative Broad's even tax rate bill last session. It might be helpful for the tax committee, just even if on an informational basis, to hear some of the bills that are out there that kind of get to the lowering and the leveling and the flattening of taxes. So I'd maybe make that as a request that we might, if possible, find some agenda time to hear those bills. And then a question for Dr. Wilson. We don't ever try and kind of calculate the benefit side of this, and I know on the fourth page of your of the actual report it says that we don't try to do anything with tax expenditures in terms of taxpayer behavior and those kinds of things. And we also, as people know from my amendment yesterday, I just think from a language standpoint we're backwards on this report, because one could equate this $10 to $11 billion expenditure that we're making as a state on these tax expenditures with the bonding expenditures and say these expenditures are actually driving these $10 to $11 billion of expenditures
are driving 200,000 jobs in the economy on an annual basis. That's 10% of our statewide employment. So if we remove these expenditures, you're actually taking away an economic driver, literally 10% of the employment in our state. So anyway, I'm wondering if there's any attempt historically or in other states to try and actually equate the benefit side of the equation on these expenditures to try and derive some kind of economic impact from them.
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Donnelly, in some ways I want to say no, but it may not quite be the right approach. There have been efforts in the states to look at the long-term economic impact of changes in tax policy. Now, that's a little different than the job creation issue. I mean, if you have a state balanced budget, it's pretty hard, while keeping the budget in balance, to create jobs. I mean, if you close all the tax expenditures, you would either lower the rate or you'd increase spending, and either one of those is going to also create jobs. So states don't have it's very hard for a state budget in terms of just moving something up or down, whether it's to have much direct effect on employment while you have a balanced budget. I mean, there are ways on the edges. But there have been states that attempted to look at the sort of the bigger picture of, you know, if you cut the corporate rate, are you going to in fact have more economic development? So the bigger questions about tax policy, if you move toward consumption away from income taxing taxation, those, you know, they refer to it as dynamic revenue estimating, is the usual term that economists use for it. Dynamic meaning just simply we look at changes over time, and we really take behavioral changes seriously in doing the analysis. The states that have done that, California has done that, quite a few other states, Washington, I think, had done that. The states that have done that have tried to create models to look at those impacts. They usually have found that they have not been very useful, and in many cases the attempt to do that has been dropped by the wayside. I don't know of any state that's currently doing that kind of analysis. The problem is the models are so complicated that nobody quite trusts the models, and the impacts usually were smaller than the proponents of the models wanted them to be, and so they didn't quite show what people were looking for. But the dynamic revenue estimating attempts, the attempts at sort of general equilibrium, looking at the whole system, but giving time for business tax cuts, for example, to take some effect. There have been some attempts to do that in some other states. We don't have such a model here, really, in Minnesota. Often it's a university that takes the task of creating that model and working on that model, because it really takes a level of expertise in the tax modeling that most states don't have.
You know, members, and I just have to throw in here, I know that's a constant frustration for people bipartisanly here. But I think people have to look at both sides of the equation here. If you're going to model when tax changes create jobs, you have to model when spending creates jobs. So, you know, you could have revenue estimates and fiscal notes that didn't just say, you know, tax cut X equals jobs amount this much. You would also have to say investment in K-12 equals this many jobs. You know, both sides of the equation create jobs. I mean, there's a rhetorical debate. I get that, you know, most people on one side want to say it's more spending that makes the economy go, and others want to say it's the cutting that makes it go. But effectively, when it's been actually formally requested, it's interesting to see the data that comes out, that when you, for example, cut LGA, you absolutely lose jobs. When you fund it, you get jobs. And it's the same thing with tax cuts. So I think what Representative Downing is saying is good. I think you just can't just have it on the taxing side. You have to have it on the spending side. And all of these things create economic activity. And trying to break them down, what do you get for a dollar in the public schools 18 years later with a productive worker? And so that's why I think it just gets so complicated. But, you know, I Representative Downing, I want to respond to you directly as far as saying, you know, what could we hear on the agenda? And I have talked to Representative Broad about that bill. And I've met with the Republicans and asked them directly, you know, how should we this year go forward in hearing bills? You know, the first 2 years I was the chair, we heard everything under the sun. We put everyone through the paces, exhausted everybody, and heard every bill from the lamest idea for the most sound, and it just about killed everybody. Representative Downing wasn't here. But then the last 2 years, we recognized the deficit and said, let's not hear ideas that aren't funded. It just seemed like a pretty simple strategy, and I already broke that rule this year because I heard the angel investment tax credit bills and the authors didn't pay for them. Okay, so we haven't really made a decision yet as a group, and we can go and start hearing all these bills where authors do not pay for them, either through cutting something or through a revenue increase, and they can go either way. But I'm willing to hear any bill that's got the whole balance paid for, and I can just tell you as one author, I have done it here with revenue increases. I have done it with tax cuts as the chief author of the corporate tax that I was just talking about. And this year I put in a bill to do the whole balanced budget with all cuts. So I've done it every way, with revenue, without, cutting taxes, raising taxes. And, you know, I have another bill, and I would encourage everybody who wants to cut to sign on. I mean, I'm cutting $500 million more than the governor. So the rhetoric works all around the room, but I think the halfway bills are the ones that members have a problem with. When spenders don't want to say how they'll pay for it, or cutters don't want to say how they'll pay for it, all these bills in the end have to be paid for. And so when members want to buy, you know, on either side of the aisle, want to come up with ideas and say how they'll do it, that's great. But, you know, having been the author of revenue increases, tax cuts, and now cutting $1.2 billion, I mean, none of them are easy. And people, you know, will say, well, let's just do this. But there aren't a lot of authors for these bills, for any of these concepts. I know of two bills right now out there in the whole legislature to cut $1.2 billion. One's mine. The governor is not one of the authors. He's cutting $700 million. So folks need to get, I think, to have the political courage to put the bills in that do that, and we can hear them. But the halfway bills, I think, where you come up with how you could give tax cuts, but you don't say how you're going to pay for it, or how you buy new programs, but you don't say how you're going to pay for it, I think they're equally not a good use of the committee's time, is what I'd say. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final comment to that point, and I know we tried to make the point on the House floor relative to the bonding bill, that expenditure likewise has a trade-off, that you are basically trading private investment and capital for public, and the bonding bill isn't free either. You got to pay that back over a 10 or a 20-year period, and so the job creation that you do get in the first couple of years when you're expending the money from the bonds is more than offset by the payments when you pay it back. So that, too, is jobs neutral. And so I think all of these things, the discussion we're having today and some of the points we've been trying to make of late, just go to the point that, you know, the fundamental decision here is whether or not the state government activity is going to be, on the whole, healthier and be a more vibrant economy than leaving it in the private sector and allowing individuals and businesses to make those decisions. So I appreciate the answers to the question and the discussion, and would look forward actually to hearing more of those bills this session if we have the time. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As usual, as I wait in this committee, a lot of the stuff actually gets said often much better by somebody else. In this case, a lot of the things that you said kind of hit on where I wanted to go, because when Dr. Wilson was making his presentation, and I apologize, I had to step out for a while to see some constituents, but I got to hear at least the beginning and going through some of the slides. A couple things struck me, and one was that the where it says on this slide, 6 tax expenditure estimates do ignore behavioral changes. That's what we've been talking about, and they do. And I wrote down, and so do spending items. Because when a lot of the things we do, especially in the health area where I do a lot of my work, you know, we don't get to count the savings for a good preventative health initiative. Just this morning in public safety finance in this room, we were talking about the DOC cutting preventative dental care to inmates. Well, that has a cost, because then they, you know, when they get serious issues, then the department has to pay for those more serious costs. There isn't any accounting on our spreadsheets for doing that more preventative care, and that's all across the board. But the other thing that's more of a question, I guess, Dr. Wilson had on line 5, when it says, you know, how tax expenditures differ from direct expenditures, and there was some discussion about there's no line in the budget. And I guess my question, I apologize if I missed this when I was out, but Now, why couldn't we have some kind of line item in the budget for this? I mean, I realize it would be a forecast, but could we have a forecast that we would, you know, why couldn't we incorporate it in some way into our budgeting process?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Leaving, I think the intent of a tax expenditure report or tax expenditure budget is to be part of the budget process. At the federal level, it's an appendix to the federal budget, the tax expenditure budget, so that the numbers are actually show up in budget documents. But of course, it basically is just simply showing money that is not collected, or you know, but basically the report gives you the numbers. Now, we don't do it in budget years simply because for our office doing both the tax incidence study and the tax expenditure study the same year, so we don't actually put this out the same year as the budget. We used to do that. It really would make more sense to do in some ways to do that at the same time as the budget, but to do both reports the same year became problematic. It was really left the legislature to decide which one to do when. But I think the answer to your question is this is, the report does in fact give you the line item or a forecast of the line item. It does say this is in some sense what is foregone as revenue because of this change, of having this tax expenditure. So it's meant to play that role, to provide that information.
Representative Lindley.
Thank you. Just a real quick follow-up. Thank you for that answer. I just wonder though, you know, we're not looking at all these things at the same time. In fact, that's one of the things in my 5 years here that I've realized is that a lot of the way we do things really prevent us from making priorities, prevent us from lining up things, even the way we do our budgeting with committees. You know, you've got something in one budget, not in another budget, and then you can't really make comparisons and set your priorities. And I just wonder if there wouldn't be a way to get this in front of us at the same time as the other stuff so that we can actually decide whether we think this thing or that thing is more important.
Representative Leaving, I think that, I mean, I understand the frustration not having the same time. The numbers, sometimes the numbers change a lot. One thing that members may notice in this tax expenditure budget is the tax expenditure report is the numbers have changed a lot from the last report in some cases. That's due largely to a major recession, which really changed growth rates and things. So that's unusual. Usually a year after the report comes out, the numbers aren't that dated, that they're actually fairly close. And of course, if you look at that as a starting point to discuss it, if you actually were going to do something to change that, you'd need a revenue estimate anyway. But I think the tax expenditure budget numbers should be reasonably useful next year for budget purpose, even though they're a year old, at least for starting. So I would say that the committee structure does create problems, as you say, because the tax committee has the child care credit and the child sliding fee program is in a different committee. Of course, if you put all those provisions into the other committees, you wouldn't have a tax committee. So, there is that issue of how do you actually, if you were trying to make these comparable so that they were actually, in some sense, competing with each other for funds, if you thought of it that way, you got to have them considered in the same committee sometime. So. Otherwise, you can't do the head-to-head comparison.
And Dr. Wilson, thank you, and tell your staff thank you for all their hard work. We appreciate it. We are adjourned, members. Thank you.